Frances Mays wants you to follow her lead to the small, untouristy towns where the old-world traditions of Italy are still a part of everyday life.
Discover some of the ways that people still live that have gotten kind of run over in contemporary life.
Coming up, the author of Under the Tuscan Sun reveals the small towns she's fallen in love with on family road trips across Italy.
It just opened my eyes to how endless Italy is and how if you had like 10 lifetimes, you could never really see all of it.
Dave Carpenter knows what goes into making a really good beer. He helps us find classic examples of lagers, pilsners, light and dark ales, where they come from in Europe.
If you've tried a German import in the U.S., and then you go to the source in Germany and you try it, it's going to taste very different.
Explore where the back roads of Italy will take him and enjoy a break with a memorable lager. It's just ahead on Travel with Rick Steves. Frances Mays helps us find what's new under the Tuscan sun in just a minute on today's Travel with Rick Steves. She tells us about off-the-beaten-track small towns all over Italy where playful and inventive new recipes take Italian culinary traditions to a new level. And later in the hour, beer expert Dave Carpenter helps us celebrate any occasion by appreciating the traditions and innovations of brewers worldwide. Ever since Frances Mays got an impulse to buy a house in Tuscany and wrote about her experience in the bestseller Under the Tuscan Sun, she's been introducing the world to the delights of living in Italy. Lately, she's been wandering off the beaten path to discover the charms of dozens of small towns and cities all across Italy. In her latest book, See You in the Piazza, she takes us along as she, her husband, and her grandson explore the kinds of places Italians treasure, free from the crush of mass tourism. Frances joins us now to explore hidden Italy from the peaks of the Dolomites to the sun-drenched tip of Sicily. Frances, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's wonderful to talk to you.
Yeah, now you've spent 30 years loving Tuscany, kind of splitting your time between the United States and Tuscany. You wrote a number of books on Tuscany, and now you're talking about Italy in general. How would you relate Tuscany to the rest of Italy?
Well, it's still the heart to me. I would always want to live there and go back there, but this book was such an adventure because I was on the road for 170 days last year, staying in all these really new to me places. And it kind of put the discovery back into travel for me. Not that, you know, it had ever gone away in Tuscany, but just finding these little tiny beach towns way in the south of Sicily mm-hmm. and waterfalls way up north near the German border. It just opened my eyes to how endless Italy is and how if you had like 10 lifetimes, you could never really see all of it.
Boy, I found that myself. You know, you've had the luxury of, you know, living near Cortona with your whole Under the Tuscan Sun experience. And that's a luxury to be actually putting down roots and getting to know the community. And then from a traveler's point of view, most of us go to Italy with just a couple of weeks and you got to see the biggies. But you had 170 days, and I'm sure you've seen Florence and Venice and Rome to your satisfaction. And now you had a chance to go to places that guidebooks don't even cover. Tell us a little bit about how you researched the book. Did you set out with 5 or 6 months and your goal was just to cover Italy from top to bottom? Did you have a list of places you wanted to see? How did that unfold?
I had a lot of places in the back of my mind, not only the places that are kind of unknown to almost anyone, but also to try to go to some of the places that get skipped. Mm-hmm. When you go travel to Siena, Assisi, Florence, Rome, etc., those are so great for a first-time trip. But after that, there's just layer and layer and layer of other stuff to see. So I wanted to see places like Genova. Everyone knows of it, but who goes there? I wanted to spend a lot of time in Parma, which often gets skipped, and places like Catania, which have a kind of bad rep, but once you get there, you really know how amazing they are. So I had this list that I wanted, but then I just set myself into a place that was central and started exploring out from there without necessarily even knowing where I was going to stop. In that way, I discovered a little tiny place in Puglia where there's a medieval bread oven, and they still make the bread there in the old ways, and people bring in their own bread with the cross on it, and just trying to make lots of touches with the, you know, old country civilization and discover some of the ways that people still live that have gotten kind of run over in contemporary life.
In Italy, it's like night and day, touristic places and places that almost never seen a tourist. And I would think the prices are about double where all the tourists go. And the folk culture and the traditions actually are more vivid in places the tourists don't go. When you talked about the place in Puglia, which had that traditional oven, talk about a little bit of how traditions survive that a tourist that just goes to the big famous places might be completely oblivious to.
The deeper you go into Italian life, the more you realize that it's bottomless and that you go to a place like Puglia, which has its famous spots, you know, but you get into the whole civilization of the place, the whole history, and that is what leads you. Like reading a little bit about Frederick II led me to explore a lot of his castles and to know how responsible he was for just the way modern Puglia is shaped. And even behind that, the whole sheep culture in Puglia and how these migration paths made the country develop the way it was. So the deeper you go, you know, the more you find out that everything you step on has a past and that it's available for you.
Now, where exactly is Puglia and what's the big city in that region?
Puglia is way south. It's down in the heel. And Brindisi is the place you can fly into. Mm-hmm. And Puglia has been kind of put on the map recently by the fact that there are now inexpensive flights from London to Brindisi. Mm-hmm. So people from there can get there in 2 hours. So that's opened it up quite a bit. But when I first went to Puglia 25 years ago, there was no one there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still such a place to discover. There are these cone-shaped houses, the Trulli, and they're in a little town called Alberobello. And it's very touristy now, but it's still magic. You feel like the elves are going to come out of these little houses at any minute. And they go back, way back to when farmers just built something out of the field stones. And they look like they've been there for a million years, but they have been there for 1,000.
Frances Mays is known for her best-selling autobiography, Under the Tuscan Sun. She's telling us about the Italian road trip destinations she features in her book, See You in the Piazza, in this interview from the Travel with Rick Steves archives. Frances has written 8 titles centered on Italy, plus others set in her home base of the American Deep South. Her website is francismaysbooks.com. So, Frances, when you're traveling, when you're venturing away from the tourist, you really find that different dimension of Italy. You could take away all the top 10 places that 95% of the tourists spend 90% of their time in, and you could still have a great country to visit. You mentioned Parma, Catania, Genova. These are places that very few people go to, even though they're great destinations in themselves. Talk about Catania a little bit. I mean, because a lot of people think the charm is in the villages, but Catania is a big, rollicking city in Sicily. And you described vividly the market in Catania. I just love you. I think you wrote, its fish market makes Venice's Rialto market look like Whole Foods.
It does. I have never experienced a market like that. The way people were shouting to sell their goods, you felt like you'd stepped back into the Middle Ages. And it's a handsome town. I had kind of fear of Catania. You know, it's a raucous seaport and had kind of a bad rep, but it's so beautiful in the interior and so civilized. The first night we were there, people were walking by our table, outside table, going to the opera. Mm-hmm. And they all looked like they stepped out of daguerreotypes. Mm. They were in their jewels and their, you know, the men had the big mustaches. And it was just one of those moments when the curtain of time seems to part.
Daguerreotypes like a 100-year-old black and white photograph?
Yes,
wow,
yes.
Wow, that is a great image.
But everyone was pouring into the opera house. So Catania is very sophisticated and civilized. And
yeah,
you just have to get beyond those stereotypes that some towns have. Like Torino, everyone thinks, oh, Fiat, you know, Alfa Romeo, cars, manufacturing. Torino is a regal town. It's an amazing culinary destination, and also the gateway to all of Piemonte with all the wines.
Mm-hmm.
But I could live in Torino. That was another aspect of all these travels, was I kept finding places I would like to live. I felt a little unfaithful to Cortona.
you're two-timing on Cortona.
I was.
Well, Torino is one of those industrial cities in the north, and I think most people would go to Milano because it's got the Leonardo da Vinci art and the great cathedral, and Torino gets overlooked.
Yes.
But I think you make a very good case in your book that Genova and Torino, there you feel the pulse of Italian urban culture, maybe even more vividly than in the places that are so packed with the tourists.
Well, you do.
You mentioned eating in Torino. Describe a good meal that you had in Torino.
Oh, there's so many. It's hard to choose. But right outside town, we drove out in a taxi. It was about a 20-minute ride to this restaurant called Combalzero. It was regal and very contemporary, very beautiful. And the chef was having fun. He did a lot of playful things. He was playing tricks on us all the time. And at the end of the meal, these little bubbles were served that you put in your mouth, and they were actually laughing gas. So he was playing tricks the whole time, but the food was enormously sophisticated. And my grandson was so impressed that they had a water menu, waters from all over the world with all the contents. So I love the basic trattorias, the mom and pop, the recipes mm-hmm. of Nona. But there's such a big movement in Italy now toward experimenting and taking the traditional ingredients and doing something fresh with them. So I love to combine those two ways of eating and traveling to try a lot of the, you know, the starred restaurants, the lauded restaurants, the ones that the chefs usually have gone away and trained. Mm-hmm. And then they've come home because they want to be with their family. Mm. And they never intended to really leave their home, but they've brought back new thinking and new information, and they're putting all this to play and to work in their restaurants.
It's funny you say the word playful, because I have also found in Italy, more than other countries, I think, chefs are kind of playful, and they're like enthusiastic, creative, young chefs, even if they've been at it for a long time. And it feels to me they want to come out and see how you reacted to their playful creation. And it just brings a sprightliness to the meal.
They do. It's fun. Like Braz in Lecce, way down in Puglia, they serve the roasted quail on a bed of straw, so he looked like he was in his nest.
And
just funny things like that. They're really having a good time. But it's not just theater. It's just kind of an attitude, I think, that they're trying to play out, not only in the food, but in the presentation.
Frances Mays bought a fixer-upper Tuscan farmhouse on a whim, and she wrote about acclimating to life in the countryside of Cortona in her bestseller, Under the Tuscan Sun. Since then, Frances has written a dozen books. She provides quick pasta recipes in one of her latest, called Pasta Veloce. Just ahead, Frances takes your calls at 877-333-RICK. As we look at the charms of small towns across Italy, which she features in See You in the Piazza. By the way, thanks to our friends at North Carolina Public Radio for helping us with today's interview. It's Travel with Rick Steves. All it requires is a sense of adventure and maybe a rental car to experience the charms of dozens of small towns all over Italy. Frances Mays writes about places she fell in love with, from the foothills of the Alps to the rugged coast of Puglia, in her book, See You in the Piazza. Frances, it was so refreshing to see you writing about towns that just don't get listed in many of the guidebooks. They sound like the kind of laid-back Italian villages we all dream about. After more than 30 years in Tuscany, what is it about Italy that still keeps it exciting for you?
I think it's because everything always seems different. You go 20 miles down the road and they're serving a different kind of pasta, or the color of the stone is different. All the towns have their own particular art, and there's just such a kind of integrity to each place. And the root of that, of course, would be that they used to not be able to travel in the Papal States, or, you know, there was no way to travel. And so all these places developed their own dialects, and they're strong still. In our town, there are two very distinct dialects, and I found, particularly in Puglia, there are even roots of Greek words still in some of the dialects.
So you're saying in your hometown of Cortona, you'd have people on different sides of the square or whatever with their own dialects?
Yes.
I found that in the Cinque Terre also. Each town in the Cinque Terre, which are little tiny villages, a half-hour walk apart, you've got different words. And I guess it is a matter of local pride. It's a matter of, in the old days, you weren't able to travel so easily. And now when you have modern infrastructure, you can pull it all together. But Italy still has that. I love that notion of the campanile. What is it called? Campanilismo?
Yes, within the sound of the bell.
Isn't that a great concept? What does campanilismo mean to you?
It means the piazza. It means the church in your town. You want to be within the sound of that bell. It just means home to you. And in our town, Cortona, there are four or five different bells that you can hear right in the piazza. And everyone knows what bell is from what church. One of them's called the nanny goat bell. One of them sounds like you're hitting a dishpan with a stick. People love their own bell. It's kind of an interesting thing.
And it's a big issue with the new priest, if he's going to ring the bell through the night or give everybody a break from midnight to 6 a.m.
Yes. But it's interesting always to me that that specialness that each town has, each region has, it comes out of that, the history of isolation. But one thing I discovered in going north to south to write this book is that every region is fantastic. I always thought, well, who wants to go to Molise? Oh, it was so beautiful. It's so rugged. And the people are just friendly and very robust cuisine, beautiful little beaches.
Where is that exactly, Molise?
Molise is way south above Puglia. It's right next to Abruzzo.
Okay. See, I'm a typical American. I don't know anything much south of Naples.
You've got to go.
I know it. Well, in your book, you say there's such a vast cultural diversity packed into a land the size of Arizona.
Yes, it's just astonishing.
You mentioned that travel is a journey into one's own ignorance. What did you mean by that?
Absolutely. One of the joys of writing this book was that I just read everything about each region and had to realize how little I knew, the successive waves of conquerors of Catania and how just the way the mountains plunge down into the sea in Catania influences the way people are. So you get into the geography, you get into the history, and then who the person is you're meeting makes a lot more sense to you.
Yeah.
It's that revelation that comes from travel that is really the reason I travel.
People are always asking me, how do you save money? What's a budget trick? And, it's going to cost you to eat well. It's going to cost you to see the great sights. And the more understanding you bring with you, the more context, the more ability you have to appreciate what you're consuming or what you're seeing or what you're enjoying, the more value it is. So my good budget tip is to do exactly what you're talking about. Know what you're looking at, and it becomes a much more rewarding experience.
Yes, the other great budget tip for Italy is the whole agriturismo idea. Those are farm stays, and the website's just agriturismo.it.
Mm-hmm.
Each region is packed. I mean, forget Airbnb.
Right.
It's just fabulous to go stay on farms with working families.
This is a farmhouse, kind of you could call it a farmhouse B&B, and to get that prestigious agriturismo title, I understand it has to be a working farm. They have to actually, it's not just a nice house in the countryside that used to be a farm. They have to have stuff going on where they make money with their agriculture or their animals, and it's a real working farm. You know, in our country, the family farms sort of just couldn't make it, but in Italy, they supplement their income by renting out rooms, and the family farms can survive. And talk about a way to connect with the people and to really connect with the culture, and you get to pet a goat, or you get to sit down at the table and have that 0-kilometer meal where everything is right off the farm.
Yes, and sometimes they will have cooking classes. They make special things for your breakfast, like a wonderful frittata, and you get to go out and get the eggs, and you get to know the family. And they can give you great tips about where to eat in town and things that you might not know to do that they know about.
Do you have a couple of favorites, Francis, as far as agriturismo go?
I've stayed in several. I've stayed in the countryside in Tuscany at very small farms in the Maremma, and that is such a wonderful area. I'm way south in Puglia, in Sicily. I've stayed in a lot of them.
Some of my favorite meals have been at the family table, and you've got generations of the mothers and fathers all around you on these portraits, and you see the family wine being poured by grandma, and it's been in the family for generations, and there's something that just makes it a beautiful experience.
It does. They're putting up the blackberry jam and they give you a jar when you leave.
I love it.
Just an intimate experience.
Anywhere in Italy, you know, you don't need to bog down on a specific recommendation. Anywhere you're going in Italy, you can get online and find the agriturismos in that area, and then you can have that more intimate countryside experience. You know, Francis, I've always wondered, you're the expert on Tuscany. You love Cortona. You've written books on Tuscany. But Tuscany has gotten quite popular. And is the Marche the next Tuscany? Or what would you recommend to people that would like, quote, the untouristy Tuscany?
So much of Tuscany is untouristy. And I hear all the time, oh, Tuscany is overrun. It's not. I mean, in mid-July, in places that tourists flock to, it's going to be kind of crowded. But here's all the rest of the year. Like if I were in Cortona right now, I doubt if there'd be any tourists there. So I'm a big one for traveling off season if you can. But even in Tuscany, like in the wine country, Montepulciano, Montalcino, Pienza, Cortona, those are popular in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not overrun. Florence can be overrun. Venice can be overrun. But I think it's very exaggerated that these small hill towns.
Or Vieto can be overrun. There's a few places that are tourist traps, but you're right. If you just venture out a little bit, you can do fine. Francis Mays is our guest right now on Travel with Rick Steves. The author of the bestseller Under the Tuscan Sun explores her favorite less explored corners of Italy in See You in the Piazza, New Places to Discover in Italy. There's more on her website. That's at francismaysbooks.com. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. You can email us anytime at radio@ricksteves.com. Gloria has called in from Daytona Beach in Florida. Gloria, thanks for your call.
Hey. Hi, Francis. Thank you so much for all your hard work and helping us through these years educate our seven daughters of their heritage, which came through Sicily.
Oh, wonderful.
And, you know, the quickest path to memory is taste and smell. So we're all about food in your cookbooks. So the question I had for you was, where would you recommend that two of our daughters, 33 and 40, are planning to go on a trip to visit the homeland and stay in a small town and immerse themselves in the culture, just the way you prescribed to get to know the real Italy? We just came back from Catania, my husband and I.
Oh.
So I was wondering, what would you suggest? Maybe Puglia, or would you suggest Tuscany?
What time of year are they going?
Well, they're teachers, so that would have to be summer.
For young women in summer, I think the little beach town of Marzamemi in the south of Sicily would just be wonderful.
Ooh,
it's a beautiful small piazza lined with gorgeous cafes. It's right on the water, right on a nature preserve. And it's also very convenient for exploring Siracusa and the Baroque towns of Noto Modica and Chicli.
Yeah.
And it's just a great base, but they would be there for this wonderful nightlife in the piazza. And I think they would absolutely
love that. Yeah, we really enjoyed
that.
Ortigia.
Gloria, let me bust in here because Ortigia is amazing. And it's a little confusing because everybody thinks of Syracuse. But the historic little island birthplace center, old center of Syracuse is Ortigia. And I found that to be one of the greatest discoveries also in Sicily. So that's nice. And I would add, I really like Francis's idea about establishing a comfortable base. And from there you side trip out. And the beach town Francis mentioned would be delightful to take advantage of the great infrastructure that Sicily has. It seems like they got better roads than they deserve. And there's probably a reason for that as the north tries to subsidize the south to keep them up to speed. And with that base that Francis mentioned, you could visit so much in southern Sicily. What was the name of that town again, Francis?
It's Marzamemi. Marzamemi.
Marzamemi. All right, Gloria, thanks for your call.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Glenn is calling in from Sun Prairie in Wisconsin.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk to Francis. I've got two quick questions, if you don't mind.
Sure.
The first is about the Albergo Diffuso movement. I've been reading about that, where they kind of try to resuscitate an old town by putting a hotel in the middle of it, but the hotel rooms themselves might be somewhere else in the village. Is this destroying those towns, or is it preserving them? What's your opinion?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because it's a great movement and it's catching on. It's a way that someone can have a hotel when they don't have a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
You check in at a central place and someone takes you to a room in town that is usually beautiful. The one we were in was over the sea. And then you go back to that office for breakfast if you want to. But it's a great neighborhood kind of experience, too, because you're not in a hotel. You have neighbors. And if you stay a few days, you can figure out what they're cooking by the scents that are coming out the door. And it's lovely. And it's reviving these towns, I think. It's not doing anything negative.
So that's Albergo.
That is really good to hear.
The word is Albergo Diffuso, and I've encountered that
diffused.
Also. It's wonderful. You have the main check-in area, and then they usually have a person who will take you to your room, even if it's a few blocks away, and set you up. And then you're situated, and you feel more like a temporary local. What was your other question, Glenn?
The other question was about this year. They always have two cities of culture in Europe, and this year it's in Italy, a little place called Matera, way down south. And I'm wondering if this would be a good year to go there, or maybe skip this year because it might be a little bit too crowded. I understand the infrastructure may not be quite up to having the number of people who are expected to go there.
That's a good point. I'm not sure about that, but it's a fascinating town, and even if you wait a year, I think it would be worth going back to. It's where all the cave dwellers were on the side of the hill. I was there 30 years ago. It was dismal indeed, and it's been so cleaned up, and nobody lives in the caves anymore, so they've become, you know, objects of interest. But the main part of the town, other than the caves, is also really a pleasant town. It's in Basilicata, so it's a little bit out of the way, but if you're traveling to Puglia, Matera used to be part of Puglia, and it's still very close, so combining a trip to Puglia with going to Matera would be a good move.
Wasn't Matera made famous with the Mel Gibson movie, The Passion?
Yes, it was filmed there. And the book Christ Stopped at Eboli features Matera.
You know, Glenn, I've never found that when these cities are made the cultural capital or whatever, it's an excuse to invest in the towns and bring them to the forefront. But I've never found that they're overrun with tourists because of that. So as Francis said, you could go the year after, but you could also go the same time. And I think you would enjoy it, especially down there. There's not a lot of tour crowds.
I was in Plovdiv last summer, which is the other city of culture. It's in Bulgaria. That's an absolutely fascinating place.
I love that. Hey, Glenn, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Frances Mays is helping us explore Italy from an interview we recorded when her book See You in the Piazza was first published. There's more at ricksteves.com/radio. And Mike's calling from Cincinnati. Mike, thanks for calling in.
Hey there, Rick. Love the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, just talking about being off the beaten path and everything. I did study abroad in all different parts of Europe, but I got to do some city hopping around Italy. And the group that I was with, they like to do more of the mainstream stuff. But every city I was in, I loved to just walk around the city on my own and just kind of see the city for myself. And I found that by walking, I got to experience the city so much more than if I was taking the train or a bus across the town.
Well, I think that's good
advice. That's what I do. The minute I get to a city, I start walking. And I think getting up early in the morning is such a wonderful thing to do because you get to see the city come awake and to get that fresh cornetto just as the pastry shop opens. And walking is the best. I think also it's a way in a place like Venice that you can really get away from the madding crowds, because as soon as you get away from tourist hotspots like in Florence too, you're out in just everywhere in Venice, lost, getting lost, finding yourself again, getting lost again. Mm-hmm. And it's lovely to discover a city like that.
I know that exact feeling in Venice, because everyone else was taking a water taxi towards our hostel, and they all had wheeling luggage in Venice of all places. And I had just my travel backpack, and I said, see you guys later. I'm walking. I had a little map that wasn't very detailed at the time, but I found myself lost near San Marco Plaza, and I had to stop and ask for directions and figured out that, you know, the address for each district, it was just a number and the name of the district. There were no street names. So I had to find that out on my own, and I wouldn't have experienced that and, you know, got to know the city if I was just taking a water taxi.
Yeah, that's good advice, and it's especially rewarding when you find yourself in what I call fiat-free Italy. Anytime you're in a traffic-free town. I think, Francis, didn't you write about the beauty of traffic-freeness in Trentino?
All over Italy, many towns are closing their historic centers to traffic, mm-hmm. and it's the best thing that's ever happened in Italy.
You wake up in downtown Florence and you hear the birds now in downtown Florence instead of trucks coming and going. It's just a beautiful thing.
It is.
Mike, we're out of time. Thanks for your call. Happy travels.
Thanks.
You know, Francis, your book covers all of the places that are not household words here among travelers in the United States, from the Dolomites to the south of Sicily. And in the very end, you came home to Cortona, your beautiful adopted hometown in Tuscany. What is it about? Just let's finish up this discussion with just what is it about coming home to Cortona for you after spending months on the road researching your new book?
I fell in love with Cortona many years ago when I just by chance rented a house outside the town. And by the end of that month, I knew that I wanted to somehow put down roots in Italy. I traveled a lot after that, looked all around at other towns, but always kept coming back to Cortona. I think there's just something in your metabolism that responds to a particular place, and that is my place.
You know, that's a real blessing to be able to go home to a place in Italy and still have your roots
yes.
in the United States. That's a beautiful thing.
I do. I wouldn't give up my time in the United States,
yeah.
but I've lived in Cortona longer than I've lived anywhere.
You're having your cake and eating it, too.
Yes, best of both worlds.
All right. Hey, Francis, thanks for joining us, and congratulations on your new book. See you in the piazza.
Thank you.
And buon viaggio.
Buon viaggio, Rick.
Dave Carpenter is a certified beer judge. He's written a definitive guide to tasting and brewing the world's most popular styles of beer. Dave helps us travel to find classic ales and lagers next on Travel with Rick Steves. Walk into just about any bar anywhere and order just a basic beer, and what you'll get is a lager. And while in the last few decades we've seen an explosion of craft ales, lagers remain the classic and largely underappreciated basic brew of the beer world. From its crisp, clean taste to its deep Bavarian history, lager is a fascinating blend of science, culture, and craftsmanship. And there's a lot more to lager than meets the eyes or lips. To help us tap into the world of lagers and learn more about the beer culture in Germany, the historic homeland of lager, I'm joined by beer enthusiast, judge, and home brewer, Dave Carpenter. His book is Lager, the definitive guide to tasting and brewing the world's most popular beer styles. And he's on a mission to help people enjoy the surprisingly diverse world of lagers. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
You know, this is so great to, we all think of beer just in a general sense. And when you think of a general beer, am I right to say it's usually get some kind of lager?
Correct. If you walk into just about any bar and you say, I'd like a beer, please, without any sort of qualification, you're probably going to get a lager.
Yeah, unless you're in Ireland.
Right.
Okay, but we'll talk about that later.
Right.
Hey, you're a certified beer judge and a Cicerone.
Correct.
I understand that's like being a sommelier, but for beer, can you explain what that's like? What is a Cicerone and how do you become one?
Oh, there are several levels in the Cicerone program. There's certified beer server, which is level one. And then level two is certified Cicerone. And then you can even go up to advanced Cicerone and master Cicerone. And it's largely consumer focused to help beer programs understand what consumers might want and to help consumers understand what they might want to order. So it's really a beer appreciation and sensory evaluation program.
So it's more than like my image of a sommelier is sips a little wine and then describes the taste and sort of assesses the quality of it. That's mm-hmm. part of it, but it sounds like it's a broader kind of approach to this drink.
Right. It's broad. So there's a very strong sensory component about being able to describe what you taste and smell. There's also a historical component of understanding how various beer styles came into being. Yeah. And there's a food and beer pairing aspect as well. Hmm. And there's a very strong even off-flavor program. So if you
were to order a beer and you say, wow, you know, I taste something that's a little like vinegar or a little like butterscotch in this. I don't think it's supposed to be there. You can give feedback to the bar owner or to the program director to improve their quality.
Hmm. So it's interesting when you think about judging excellence, because in my travels, I've encountered, you know, cheese, and people are really into that in some corners, mm-hmm. and olive oil, people will go to the mat mm-hmm. for this or that olive oil. Everybody knows about wine, and beer. So now, how good is a great beer? You hear about these beers in Belgium that are sold out, you know, a year in advance, right? Small
right.
craft beers, really appreciated. Is it some kind of a mystique, or is it actually that some beers are, from your ability to taste them, some beers are just in a whole league on their own, you know?
Sure. I would preface all of it by saying the best beer is the one you enjoy drinking the most. So if it's a beer that you like, don't let any judge tell you otherwise. It really is up to the consumer to learn and appreciate what they like. But when you're talking about excellence in beer, competitions are typically arranged according to style, and there's a numerical scale. And so when you sit down with other judges to evaluate, is this a world-class beer? You're looking at the beer in the glass, you're swirling it around, you're judging the aroma, the mouthfeel, the flavor, and just your overall enjoyment. And each of those has a score, you add them up, and at the end you say, well, this is a 40-point out of 50 beer, which is anything above 40 is really a world-class beer. So you can have many, many beers that would fall into that category.
But you might not like that kind of beer, but it could be an excellent beer. Like, what's the famous one in Cologne, Kolsch or something
Kolsch,
like that?
The Kolsch, correct. Uh-huh.
I just don't like Kolsch.
Mm-hmm.
So if you went to a beer tasting event and you're tasting Kolsch, well, I don't like that kind of beer, but
right.
but you could find a great Kolsch.
You can find a great Kolsch. And, you know, when you're evaluating, you try to stick to things that you do enjoy, but a good judge should be able to, as objectively as possible, taste a beer, even if it's not a style that you necessarily would drink daily, to pick it apart and say, this is a good example of this style.
That's such a diplomatic way to put it. I said, I don't like it. You said, well, I wouldn't drink it daily. You found your right niche, I think. Well, so Germany is just a great place to be a beer aficionado.
And, it really is.
And you lived there, actually, and you did. You were a beer judge in all over around in Europe. But I would imagine for a person who loves beer, especially lager, you found the right place to really settle in.
Germany really is the place to be for lager drinkers. There's a wide range of lager styles that you can find there, and there's a local appreciation for, you know, what is the beer that's served in this region. You know, one thing that really I found striking was how you could travel not very far and the range of beers available would change.
Oh, it is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you go to Berlin and every neighborhood has its favorite beer garden.
Right.
And that beer garden is associated with a particular brew, right?
With a particular brewery, correct, yeah.
Great loyalty also. I mean, people grow up, their father went to this one, and that's where he or she goes.
Right.
I love to just test the different, when I'm doing my guidebook, you know, to Germany, I just love the beer halls from a culture, eating, ambiance, conviviality, and beer point of view, and good basic food also. And
right.
I'm just enamored with Andex. Do you know Andex?
I do know Andex. Unfortunately, I've not been there myself, but it's quite famous, yeah.
So that's a monastery just south of Munich.
Right.
And it's got a great history, a great loyal following, almost like a soccer team or a football team following.
Right.
And people would, if there was a t-shirt to wear, they'd wear the Andex t-shirt. And
right.
I just love that. It's really fun to get caught up in that.
It is. I have in-laws who live near Munich. They live in a village south of Munich, and they are an Augustiner family. That's what they've been drinking
there you
for
go.
Years.
Augustiner.
Yes.
And part of that's the heritage, the ambiance they create at the beer garden, which is sort of the mecca of that particular beer, I would imagine.
It
is. And then they have this wonderful festival where they all have their own floats and parades. And, you know, Oktoberfest gives the word float a whole different meaning, I think. You got these floats that are just with the beer maids and the big mugs and the giant kegs and parading through the city, and it's almost like, oh, here comes my high school marching band, you know, oh, here comes my
right.
beer hall's float.
This is my brewery's float, right.
I love it. Certified beer judge, home brewer, and journalist Dave Carpenter is with us from his home base in Fort Collins, Colorado right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Dave spent a couple years in Berlin to learn the time-honored craft of European brewing traditions. He's written Lager as a guide to tasting and brewing the world's most popular styles of beer. Dave's also the author of The Illustrated Guide to Home Brewing. His website is davecarpenterbooks.com. So, this book that you've written, Dave, Lager, how would you define lager as opposed to beer in general? I mean, what is lager and why is it so basic?
Without getting too technical, beer is, you know, a malt beverage that's fermented using yeast. And if you're a baker, you're already using the yeast that is used for ales. Saccharomyces cerevisiae is the name of the yeast. And those yeasts work well at around room temperature. And that's what you'll find in the British Isles. That's what you'll find in Belgium, largely. But lager is fermented using a type of yeast that excels in cold climates. It excels at, you know, 45 to 55 degrees Fahrenheit, which is why you often see caves associated with lager brewing in Europe. And so it's by having those cold temperatures, the yeast is sort of prohibited from producing some of the flavors you might get with an ale. So it's much more of a cleaner expression of the malt and hops.
So even the word lager, I learned in your book, comes from the German word for to store.
Like to store.
In a big refrigerator, which in the Middle Ages would have been a cave.
Would have been a cave.
And what does that have to do with chestnut trees? Because you always find a chestnut tree seems to be the, almost like, you know, when you have an event in the United States, they have those searchlights in the sky going around.
Right.
It marks this event. And in Germany, when you see a chestnut tree, you see a bunch of picnic tables under it. And
right. There's
would there be caves nearby, and would that actually go back?
Yep. You found yourself a beer garden or a keller. So keller means cellar. So underground storage is historically one way to keep beer cool. And over time, the breweries learned that if you covered those caves up with a little bit of dirt, some mulch, and chestnut trees, that would shade the caves even better, keep things cooler. And then eventually, it's not that much of a stretch to say, we can serve directly from these caves. And then you have the beer garden.
And people would traditionally bring their picnic and buy a beer, and that would
absolutely be
the community gathering place.
And voila. You can still bring food to any beer garden. Even those that serve food, you can still bring your own.
I like that. In fact, as a travel tip, if it's got a tablecloth, I think they expect you to order from the menu. But if there's no tablecloth, BYO picnic.
Absolutely.
So when I think of lager, it seems to me if you want a cold, refreshing beer, kind of a crispy beer, it's going to be a lager.
Yep. Or a Kolsch.
Or so if you want a cold and refreshing beer, you want a lager. And half of your book, it seems like, is just making it really clear all these different types of lagers. And that's an important sort of vocabulary for somebody who's traveling around and wants to know what the options are. Of course, when you go to a beer hall in Germany, you'll be asked, do you want dunkel or helles, dark or light?
Right.
And then when you go to the Czech Republic, you find a pilsner, right?
Right.
What are these basic terms? Give us a little practical vocabulary.
Sure. So there are a few terms that are really good to know when you're traveling around Central Europe. If you're in Germany, like you said, dunkel or dunkles is a dark beer. Hell or helles is a light beer. And those are going to be dark and light lagers.
Uh-huh.
If you are in the Czech Republic, the word for beer is pivo.
But that's a lager. So the word in the Czech Republic for beer assumes it's a lager.
Yes. Czech brewing is lager brewing. And in fact, Czech Republic is where we get Pilsner from.
Because my favorite beer in Europe, my favorite lager in Europe, I would stipulate, would be a Czech Pilsner, Pilsner Urquhart.
Pilsner Urquell.
Mm-hmm. Urquell, thank you. But I conditioned that on my favorite lager. See, I'm
your
getting better
lager.
Just talking
yes.
to you. Because I could argue when I'm in the right mood, a Belgian beer I enjoy more than my mm-hmm. Pilsner Urquell. But the Belgian beer is a whole different animal.
And you can get Belgian lagers. Every country has lagers. But I would I would argue that when you're in Belgium, the ales there are the way to go.
Just like wine. I mean, you know, I think you'd order a heavy, full-bodied red wine in Tuscany, and you might want mm-hmm. a white wine on the Rhine River.
Absolutely.
So when I'm in Czech Republic and I order a beer, I get a Pilsner. I get a, mm-hmm. depending on the pub I'm in, it's probably a Pilsner Urquhart.
Mm-hmm.
What am I liking so much about that?
About the Czech Pilsner?
Yeah. Because they say after the fall of the Soviet Union, there was a lot of emigration, a lot of workers leaving their countries in the former Warsaw Pact. They would go to the West where they'd get a good job. But the country that had the least of that kind of worker emigration was the Czech Republic, because those Czech workers just could not imagine living without their Pilsner
beer. Sure. There are a couple of things that sort of define a Czech lager. One is that they really stick to tradition. So even as German brew houses have modernized, the Czech brew houses tend to be very traditional, and they use what's called a triple decoction mash, which is a very labor and energy intensive mashing regimen. And they also use special strains of yeast that are very unique to the Czech Republic, and they give a rounder, fuller mouthfeel in the finished beer. So it ends up being something that you can drink quite a lot of.
Mouthfeel. See, there's another thing that you would think in terms of wine, or at least I would, because right. I'm new to this recognition that you can approach beer with the same sort of finesse and nuance that you can approach wine. And that's the cool thing about your book. So mouthfeel is something, and you've got a whole chapter on these kind of dimensions of how to taste and appreciate your lager.
Right, the sensory aspects of beer appreciation.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Dave Carpenter. His book is Lager, the Definitive Guide to Tasting and Brewing the World's Most Popular Beer Styles. One dimension of this that people, I think, tend to underestimate, and you do not underestimate in the book, is glassware. And people don't realize that a bartender in a German beer garden is concerned about the glass.
For sure. You know, there's a glass for every beer. And glasses have developed, and sometimes due to marketing, but often due to their abilities to enhance certain sensory aspects of the beer you're drinking. Hefeweizen is not a lager, but it's a German wheat ale, and it is always served in a slender vase-shaped glass, and that accentuates the moussey head on the beer.
Okay, so you'll notice that when you go to the Hofbrauhaus, that there's generally these big mugs with big handles, except for the Hefeweizen.
Except for the Hefeweizen.
So at a glance, you can say, ah, they're drinking that more fizzy beer.
Right.
And then what's the Maßkrug?
The Maßkrug.
The Maßkrug. That's the big, heavy one that you can slam it down on the table.
Right.
And it's what the tourists, all the kids back when I was a kid wanted to steal, a Maßkrug from the Hofbrauhaus.
Right.
They had bouncers at the door keeping you, checking your bag
to
see if you had one of those big. And of course, a Maßkrug is as big as a liter pitcher.
Right.
Literally, because it's a liter, ein Maß.
Mm-hmm. It's a liter of beer. And some people will say that the beer gets too warm by the end. And I think the Bavarians would say you need to drink it faster.
Ah, that's the perfect Bavarian answer. And it's quite traditional. You got to have that heavy glass Maßkrug. Now, somebody told me this, and you hear a lot on the road, and a lot of it might be just folk legends, but the Maßkrug is so big it can be used as a weapon.
And it's I believe that.
in Germany, it's considered a serious offense if you hit somebody with intent to beat them up with your Maßkrug. In fact, they were going to outlaw the Maßkrugs, and they designed a thing where the handle breaks off before you can kill somebody with it.
I haven't heard that. No, I like it.
Check that out.
I will.
I think your book is full of fun little facts. And I thought that was a fun fact, but I'm not able to substantiate it.
Well, I do love a bit of folklore, and I'm going to look that up, and it sounds great to me.
What's the importance of freshness and seasonality? Does that have anything to do with, I mean, seasonality wouldn't really make sense, but the freshness of the beer?
Oh, I think both make a lot of sense. If you've tried a German import in the U.S., and then you go to the source in Germany and you try it, it's going to taste very different.
A lot of people say a Guinness doesn't travel well. So, you know, if you love Guinness in Dublin and then you go to Arizona and you try one, it's just not going to be the same.
It's not the same.
Right.
And part of that is the Guinness Brewery has a lot of influence in Ireland, and they go to great lengths to check your draft quality and how you're pouring the beer. So Guinness is on the ground, sort of like the beer police in Ireland.
And it is kind of, I would suppose, for the German beer enthusiast to hear the sound of that keg being tapped. It just sort of gets your endorphins doing flip-flops.
It does. There's a tradition among many Bavarian breweries to do beer from a wooden keg on special days of the week.
Sure. Do you know there's a big beer garden just off the Victualian market in Munich called Pischor, I think?
Uh-huh.
And they're famous for their wooden kegs.
Yeah.
And apparently there's that happy sound when they can't, and everybody goes, yeah, it's like,
right.
It's like in Spain when the paella is coming out of the oven,
right.
You know, and people just kind of go for it right away. And they've evolved to have more modern kegs that aren't tapped with a sound, and they're metal kegs instead of wooden kegs. But they still make that sound, even if it's not for real.
They still make that sound. And one thing that's really special about those wooden kegs is you have to finish the whole keg in that day. It doesn't age. So a regular keg.
That's forced freshness.
Regular keg you're topping up with carbon dioxide, and those are just open to the air, and you've got to finish it.
And I see the look on your face right now, Dave. That's like sacrilege. Say it ain't so.
Yeah.
You're taking a good beer and you're filling it up with other, to make it so you can drink it stale tomorrow.
Right.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Dave Carpenter and his book. It's a whole wonder world to realize all the nuance in the beer world before you travel and to be able to appreciate that. And it's certainly drinkable culture. His book is called Lager, The Definitive Guide to Tasting and Brewing the World's Most Popular Beer Styles. Dave, thanks so much for joining us. And what do you say in a German beer hall when you're clinking your glass?
Prost.
Prost. All right. Happy travels.
Happy travels.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton with Casimir Hall and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Sheila Gerzoff handles affiliate promotions. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Take a look at Rick's list for what to pack in your suitcase and share tips with fellow travelers. It's part of our online travel forum. It's at ricksteves.com. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Hey, I'm Rick Steves. Thanks for listening. In our online travel store, you can choose from 80 different Rick Steves guidebooks covering just about every country, region, and major city in Europe, as well as books on history, art, Italian food, cruising, and festivals, plus phrase books and planning maps. You'll find my favorite bag, the one I designed and I live out of for 100 days a year, and a selection of other custom-designed bags, backpacks and wheeled bags, big and small. Plus a selection of accessories that experienced travelers won't leave home without. It's all at ricksteves.com.